This show proudly sponsored by Real American Freestyle Wrestling.
Living with schizophrenia isn't easy, especially when you're not getting relief from some of your symptoms. It can be hard when you're still dealing with symptoms, like hearing voices or seeing things that aren't there. And negative symptoms, like feeling unmotivated or avoiding social situations. If this sounds familiar, it might be time to talk to your healthcare provider and explore a different kind of schizophrenia treatment. Discover your possibilities at treatingscz.com.
Hi, this is Javon, your Blinds.com design consultant.
Oh, wow, a real person.
Yep, I'm here to help with everything from selecting the perfect window treatments to...
Well, I've got a complicated project.
No problem. I can even help schedule a professional measure and install. We can also send you samples fast and free.
I just might have to do more.
Whatever you need.
So the first room we're looking at is for...
Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 40% site-wide. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions apply.
Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Well, actually, it's Jason Chaffetz, most approachable guy. I bet you can't find him. He's in hiding. He's on a little vacation, and I'm thrilled to fill in his seat. Did yesterday, and I'm here today. So thank you so much for joining us on the Brian Kilmeade Show. We got a lot to cover, a lot of ground out there. And, you know, we got to start with the biggest story in the country. And it's all that flooding. When you look at the flooding and the serious, I mean, some stations are now reporting there's still more than 170 people missing after the flooding. This after more than 100 are confirmed dead. And it just keeps going. You also have flooding in other parts of the country. In New Mexico, three are dead after some serious rise in rivers there. And these horrific pictures of homes just being washed away. I want to give a shout out to, we got two affiliates there, KINN and KENN. Both there in New Mexico, I'm sure, covering this and concerned about their listeners there in New Mexico. New Mexico is a pretty decent-sized state, but nevertheless, it's happening in other states as well. But certainly the Texas tragedy, it's one of the biggest losses of life in our country's history. And here to kind of give us some perspective, somebody who's always, like when there's bad things happening, interesting things happening, crazy things happening, fun things happening. Griff Jenkins from Fox, you see him there. I've seen you all over the world, my friend. Thank you so much for joining us on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, Jason, it is awesome to be with you, and you are doing a fantastic job filling in for Brian on vacation. But, you know, you're raising such an important point, and that is the story of this Texas flooding really hit home for me when we heard yesterday Texas Governor Greg Abbott saying that there have been more people killed in this area, in Kerrville County and in the surrounding counties, than in Hurricane Harvey, the historic hurricane that hit Houston and the flooding there. I was in the middle of that literally for a week or more. And, you know, all of a sudden, obviously, we have seen the death toll rising. We now know 170 still missing. You really begin to grasp the magnitude of this tragedy and the stories. I've been filling in some for Brian on Fox and Friends in the morning, and the stories coming are just heartbreaking. And now, as you mentioned too, we had video from out in Ruidoso, New Mexico, of an entire house floating down a river. They had water that rose some 20 feet in a very short period of time. And, you know, it's a reminder that Mother Nature is a force that cannot be reckoned with sometimes.
Well, and Griff, I've seen you, look, I've seen you doing some really fun, funny stuff on Fox and Friends or Fox. I mean, you name it, you've probably done it. I've seen you in war zones, but I'm touched. I remember there was one time I was on Outnumbered, and I hadn't done it very much. You know, there, the Fox show that comes on at noon Eastern, And but we went live because there was all this, there was a hurricane aftermath, and you were standing kind of knee deep in water, and the woman was just saying, "I lost everything," and I got so emotional just watching it.
Yeah.
And yet you stood there with composure. Those, when you're interviewing and talking to people who've literally just had their lives washed away, or just devastated with a tornado or something like that, talk to me about people who have suddenly found themselves on that side of the equation. And what it's like, how do you stand there with that composure and do it? But it's just, you know, what do you ask somebody? Is it a comfort that they're interviewing and that they get to talk about it?
No. And you know, it's a great question, Jason. And I've been privileged to have been given the opportunity and honor to cover historic events. And in this case, many of them natural disasters. But you know, when you are meeting these people, you're, you know, in what is a developing catastrophe for these individuals, and you realize you have to sort of steel yourself and put yourself in a professional mindset to realize this story, this individual's story, is such an important part of the entire fabric of the story of the storm or the natural disaster, or in some cases, the war zone or whatever has happened. And that these people, in the case of the interview you're talking about, and you're very kind to say, give me kudos for that, but you know, it wasn't me. And what you ultimately want to do is just give those people an outlet to let the world know their story so that they can understand.
Right.
Now, sure, it certainly serves a little bit of a purpose to also put a spotlight on it so that the officials back in Washington are making sure they heed that there may be federal help needed, and certainly for the local communities. But, you know, one of the stories that recently touched me was a few months back when I was covering Hurricane Helene that had really hit Western North Carolina so hard. And it was, you know, one of the more rural areas, and hurricanes don't typically really ravage Western North Carolina, but the flooding in this case did. And there was, you know, a weak initial response by the federal government. This is the previous administration, and you had people like Samaritan's Purse, a group called Savage Operations, that really just dropped what they were doing, banded together, and came to try and help these people. And in one case, there was a elderly woman that had no power and had, you know, couldn't get access to her medicine and whatnot. And, you know, we were able to help her and give our phones to her and let her contact her daughter so that her daughter could find some way. The road in and out had been knocked down. So one of the teams we were with took her out of there. And so in some cases, you know, it can be not only important to allow these people to tell their stories, which are so important for the country to hear, but also life-saving situations to try and help with any resources we have.
Well, and that's the devastation. Like I said, not only is it still playing itself out in Texas, you hope for a miracle there and some sort of rescue, but 170 still missing. And look, they got all of Texas trying to get down there and help and sort through this and try to find people, and hopefully there's just some miscommunication and that number isn't so high. But you also have it playing out in New Mexico, and not as many cameras or people necessarily there in certain parts of New Mexico. It's one of our most beautiful states. I also wanted to mention KOBE up in Las Cruces. You know, they too are, they've got an audience that cares, and you know, even though you don't have all the cameras, there's still, I mean, that flood is crazy big. And we've had things happening in North Carolina as well. But I just hope that people can remember and not forget, and, you know, they can help out where they possibly can. And so anyway, it's you've covered it, and it's hard and it's heart wrenching, but let's move on to something easier and a little softer, if you can, this morning. And let's go to immigration.
Yeah, that's a soft issue. Immigration.
That's a soft
I'll
one.
I'll tell you, man. I'll let you finish what you were going to say, but, you know, I will just say it again and again. And on Twitter last night, I've been vilified by the left, by people that are putting ICE agents and officers and Border Patrol in unprecedented levels of assault, you know, assaults on ICE up nearly 700%. But there was one chief, Border Patrol chief, Greg Bolvino of the El Centro sector in California, had put a picture of tires, some makeshift spikes had taken out some Border Patrol tires, and they arrested the individuals that did that, fortunately. But, you know, it wasn't an assault, but it was certainly an attack of sorts. And I just put something out there saying, you know, not opining, but just pointing out, this must stop. And the rhetoric against these federal immigration officers carrying out federal immigration law has got to end, because we're headed to a very dangerous place in this country, regardless of what your politics are.
Well, let's listen to Tom Homan. He's obviously the Trump administration border czar. Somebody with deep, you know, decades of experience here. Cut 30.
We're going to do the job. We're going to do it in Portland, too. But for the mayor of New York City and Chicago, President Trump made it clear 2 weeks ago. We're going to double down and triple down on sanctuary cities. Yes. Why? Not because they're blue. Because we know there are recent public safety threats to the streets every day. Like Florida, we agree with all the sheriffs in Florida. They're taking our detainers. They're not releasing illegal alien public safety threats. They're calling us. So we could spend less resources in Florida and send them to New York and Chicago and to Portland and L.A. We're going to double down and triple down on sanctuary cities. If we can't arrest a bad guy in the jail, then we'll go to community and we'll find him. Or we'll do more worksite enforcement. We'll find him at the worksite. And when we do these things and we ramp up that enforcement, we're going to find others who aren't a criminal target, but they're in the country illegally. We're going to arrest them, too.
Yeah, if anybody doubts the resolve of the Trump administration and Tom Homan and Kristi Noem and all that, you know, they got another thing coming. But this idea that they're going to intimidate ICE, that they're going to dox ICE, that they're going to, you know, now there's this thing about, oh, how dare you wear masks? Well, it's because you're threatening to dox these people and you want their facial recognition so that you can then go get their information and track down their families. That's why they're doing that.
Yeah. And, you know, it's important in all of this that people take a step back and realize these are real human beings. These are men and women who chose to answer the call to serve. In this case, federal immigration law enforcement, putting themselves in danger and at risk just by the job's description, now being targeted in an unprecedented way and assaulted. And you have to think about the human reality of it. You know, these spouses of these agents and officers, the children are terrified knowing that their mom or dad or brother or sister could come to great harm on any given day just trying to do their job. You look at just the number of incidences, whether it was the Border Patrol annex facility in McAllen, Texas, where we just saw the individual come out with a assault rifle firing. He was killed by Border Patrol response, but yet this was a armed attack. And then you had, of course, in Alvarado, Texas, 10 individuals arrested, charged now with trying to kill, first-degree murder charges on a federal immigration officer. We're learning more about that incident. This was an ICE facility. An ICE officer was shot in the neck. Fortunately, he's going to be okay. But we're learning that these individuals were coordinating this. They had assault rifles. They were firing from different positions, advantage points, one from far away that hit the guy in the neck. But they were also wearing body armor. They had cell phones in a Faraday bag, which is used to design.
Ready to shoot.
To try and, you know, hide their identities. And so, you know, it's certainly unacceptable that in the passion of some sort of protest that we've seen violence explode, but this is a whole different animal when you're talking about a premeditated, coordinated attack by an organized group.
Well, and look, these officers, I've just never understood conceptually the whole idea of a sanctuary city. You have somebody who's a criminal, like, you know, here illegally, but then they've also committed a crime. And why they think they have a moral obligation, that it's the higher moral ground to hide this person and assist and harbor this person, that makes absolutely no sense to me. I've never understood the concept.
It makes no sense whatsoever, and there's a hypocrisy of it as well. Now, I will tell you, because I've reported a lot on the sanctuary city stuff, some will tell you that the original intent of a sanctuary city was a local effort in a community to try and make the immigrant population not intimidated by law enforcement. Why? Because they feared that when the people in the immigrant community had an emergency and needed to dial 911 for help, domestic right. abuse or other things, they wouldn't think twice about doing it because they were feared that they would, you know, in their time of crisis, then be, deported and rounded up. And so that's the intent. Okay, I can get there. But look at what it's become. It's become this political, I would argue, losing political play on the clear top of the cards to play for the Democrat Party, doubling down in places like Boston, like Chicago, like Los Angeles, that are absolutely enforcing zero cooperation with federal law enforcement, and they are releasing onto the streets these individuals who have convictions for homicide, child sexual assault, domestic abuse, you name it, the list goes on and on. ICE, DHS, CBP, Border Patrol puts out daily pictures and stories and rap sheets of these individuals that are being released. And Homan is now having to go out, as he said in that soundbite, at large, make at large arrests because the local and state officials just release them to the streets. And the hypocrisy, last point, is do you know who's at greatest risk of violence from those criminals? The immigrant community itself,
exactly.
that a sanctuary law exactly. was always intended to protect.
Exactly. Well, look, I know Griff Jenkins, if it involves a bulletproof vest or waders or a bathing suit, you're going to be there. Griff
Sign
Jenkins, thank you so much for joining us on the Brian Kilmeade Show. We'll be right back.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
It's Will Tang Country. Watch it live at noon Eastern, Monday through Thursday at foxnews.com or on the Fox News YouTube channel. And don't miss the show. Listen and follow the podcast 5 days a week at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts. A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Big day on Capitol Hill.
Is there a doctor in the house?
Oh, yes, there is supposed to be a doctor in the house. Dr. Kevin O'Connor is supposed to appear before the House Oversight Committee for a transcribed interview where he will have to, under oath, be able to give some testimony about the condition of the president, President Biden, at the time. As you know, James Comer and the Oversight Committee is conducting an investigation about the cognitive capabilities of Donald Trump, of Joe Biden. And so this is really going to be an interesting one. Look, I used to be the former chairman of this committee. You got a reluctant witness, somebody who tried to get out of it and say, hey, there's HIPAA laws. I get executive privilege. The White House under Donald Trump can waive that privilege. He did waive that privilege. Now the question is he going to plead the fifth? Is he going to be insightful? Is he going to say, hey, there's HIPAA laws that prohibit me from talking about these things? We don't know how it's going to play out, but he's soon supposed to appear up on Capitol Hill. Even though the House is in recess, there's still a lot of work going on behind the scenes. Dr. Kevin O'Connor there before the Oversight Committee. We got a lot to continue to talk about here on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Stay with us. We're going to be right back.
It is time to take the quiz.
It's five questions in less than 5 minutes. We ask people on the streets of New York City to play along. Let's see how you do.
Take the quiz every day at thequiz.fox. Then come back here to see how you did.
Thank you for taking the quiz.
A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Well, it's actually Jason Chaffetz. I'm filling in for Brian today. He's one of the hardest working people, period. He does, you know, 3 hours of television, 3 hours of radio. Then he does a weekend show. It's just unbelievable. But he's out today, and I'm fortunate to fill in his seat and thrilled to have this next guest with us, Michael Whatley. He's the chairman of the Republican National Committee, the RNC. Chairman Whatley, thanks so much for joining us on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
It's great to be on with you, Jason.
You know, I actually saw you. I'm here in Washington, D.C. We're not sitting in the studio right next to each other, but I saw you at lunch, but you're kind of across the room. And then when I looked over again, you were gone. I'm sorry to miss you, but now it's great to talk to you on the radio. So, yeah. Hey, I wrote a book. It's just out. It's new. It's called They're Coming For You. And I dedicate a significant part of the book to this idea that if you think elections are just straight up, hey, show up and vote, you got another thing coming. That data and information is being used about you to target you or to not target you or to target the Democrats to get out the vote. But you're doing some things that I'm glad that are happening because you're really trying to help clean up the voter rolls there across the country. Tell us about what you're working on and how what the RNC is doing to make sure we got free, fair, and accurate elections with integrity.
Yeah, you know, when I came on board as the chair after President Trump had asked me to take over the RNC last year, we had breakfast, and one of the things that we talked about was, you know, we really need to be doing two things at the RNC. One is to get out the vote, and the other is to protect the ballot. The RNC has historically always worked on getting out the vote, but we had never had a protect the ballot, you know, election integrity campaign before. And in order to put that together last year, we really needed to focus on three things. You know, first off, we want to make sure we have the right rules of the road in place before voting starts. You know, things like voter ID and only American citizens can vote. You know, states need to clean up their voter rolls and basic protections for mail-in ballots, right? Number two, you got to be in the room. So we want, you know, Republican poll workers, Republican judges, Republican observers, Republican attorneys in every room where votes are being cast or counted. And third, you got to talk about it. Like, we need everybody to understand we're going to be there. Because we want every Republican to know your vote is going to be protected. It's not going to be canceled out by cheating. And it is very worthwhile for you to go out and actually cast your vote and trust in the system. And the flip side is, if you're contemplating cheating or helping somebody else cheat, you need to know that we're going to find you and we're going to prosecute you to the fullest extent of the law.
You know, there's a lot of states out there that go out there and say, oh, well, there's never been any evidence. There's no suggestion that it isn't safe. That's just a bunch of chatter online on social media. But what's your perspective of that?
Well, look, if we can put in a program that is going to prevent cheating from happening, I am perfectly happy with that scenario. I think optimally that's where we want to be. But we have definitely seen examples over the years where people cheat, where people, you know, are stuffing the ballot box, where people are bringing in extra ballots. They're doing ballot harvesting, things like that. And so we see, you know, this very steady drip of cases and prosecutions that are being brought up across the country. And every time, you know, our response is, huh, I thought that didn't happen. You know, now what I can say is with the right programs in place, we could prevent a big systematic event from taking place. And there's always going to be things around the edges. There's going to be one-offs. You know, on Election Day last year, we addressed over 20,000 different complaints that came in through our war rooms all across the country where we were able to address those issues. And for 90, 95% of them, we were able to solve them right there on the spot just because we had attorneys and observers and were able to get the improper activity taken care of.
Now, part of this, part of what the RNC is doing, I see here that the RNC sued in Arizona to clean up the voter rolls, because it's kind of shocking how many people who may not be eligible, maybe dead, maybe all kinds of things, are still on the voter rolls. So if you don't, it starts with making sure that only legal, lawful people are actually on those voter rolls, right?
Yeah, and so in every single state, we have sent legal demand letters to the state attorney general, to the state, you know, secretary of state, the boards of elections, you know, whoever the proper official is, that says, look, it is federal law that you have to clean up your voter roll every single year. We want to know the last time you did it, and we want to make sure you're going to do it this year. So that's the first thing that we've done. We've sent that out to all 50 states. And then we also have situations in Arizona and in North Carolina, a couple others, where you don't even have to prove that you're a citizen of the state to be able to vote from overseas. So we have people that are voting from overseas that have no relationship with the state of Arizona. They just happen to register to vote there. That is clearly not complying with the Arizona Constitution, which requires you to be an Arizona, you know, citizen for you to vote there. So that's why we filed that lawsuit there. We also have a very similar one that we just won in North Carolina as well.
That's crazy. That I mean, I don't understand why it's so hard and difficult for people to say, look, we should all vote same day, same time, same information in person with a voter ID. Now, maybe the RNC is not going as far as I'm going, but I personally, I really don't like vote by mail. I think there's certain situations, our military is serving overseas. We have some people that are, you know, incapable of getting to a polling place. You know, I'm thinking of people in assisted living centers or in a hospital. But above and beyond that, I just think everybody should show up same day with a voter ID. Is that too far?
I don't think it is too far. I think that what we're looking at right now is a lot of scenarios where we do have states that allow absentee ballots. They allow voting by mail. What we want is basic protections in place to make sure that we are going to minimize the fraud. You know, so things like a witness requirement, a signature requirement, the fact that the voter has to request the ballot, you can't just send it out to them. You know, we want those ballots in mailboxes, not drop boxes. And we really, truly want to make sure that those ballots are in by Election Day. We filed a number of lawsuits around the country, and we've engaged in litigation just this week in Kansas, where we're saying that you have to have those ballots in by Election Day. Election Day means Election Day. It's in the Constitution. It's not election week. We don't want ballots coming in 10 days after the election or 7 days after the election. We think that even if they're by mail, they still need to be in by Election Day so that we can get a count and we can understand who won.
That sounds so unreasonable. I mean, what you're talking about is just common sense. You would think that integrity of the ballot, it would be paramount to so many people. But like I said, I wrote this book, They're Coming for You, and it opens up the book by talking about right away how the Biden administration engaged with by using data that only the federal government has, government data about housing, about incarceration, about all these things, that the data that they have on people, and then targeting them using federal officials, federal resources, federal money, physical facilities. And guess what? They were targeting Democrats and trying to get out the vote and using all those things to help perpetuate the Democrat, in this case, you know, Kamala Harris, to get out the vote. You know, fortunately, I think Donald Trump was just dominating. It was almost too big to rig. I've heard that said along the way. And I think that's true, that there was so much support out there for Donald Trump. But, you know, that's why I wrote this book, They're Coming for You, because they're using this data to go out and target you and push you out of the economy and also push you off the ballot box. It's really interesting that way. Chairman, one other thing. What else is the RNC doing that most people don't realize, and what can they do to get in contact and help you out?
You know, the other side of our coin, right, really, when we talk about what the RNC fundamentally is going to do, obviously we're going to support the administration. We're going to do whatever we can to support the president, Congress, as they're moving forward. And thank God we got the big, beautiful right. bill done. And the election integrity program is obviously massive for us. The other thing we're going to do is we're going to get out the vote. And I think that fundamentally, when people think about the RNC, that's what they really think about. It's the victory programs that we run, you know, in every state around the country to make sure that we're recruiting and training the volunteers. We're making the phone calls. We're knocking on the doors. We're sending out the direct mail. We're working with the candidates to make sure that we have an informed electorate, because what we have seen over the course of the last 20, 30 years is when voters understand the issues and they understand where Republicans stand and where Democrats stand, they're going to vote Republican. The Democrats always have a ton of money. And so what we need to do is make sure that we are in the most effective, efficient way, you know, spending every single dollar to make sure that we are going out there. We're recruiting those volunteers. We're training them. We're turning them loose. We're making sure that everybody understands Republicans are listening to the voters. We understand their issues and we're putting solutions on the table, and the Democrats are trying to take this woke, you know, progressive radical ideology out of New York and California and jam it down the throats of the American people.
Yeah, the Zohran Mamdani party that they're morphing into. Michael Whatley, RNC chairman, doing an amazing job. One of the best chairmen we've ever had in the Republican Party. Michael Whatley, thanks so much for joining us on the Brian Kilmeade Show. We'll be right back.
You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, I'm Trey Gowdy, host of the Trey Gowdy Podcast. I hope you will join me every Tuesday and Thursday as we navigate life together and hopefully find ourselves a little bit better on the other side.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, this is Jason Chaffetz filling in for Brian, and a lot happening in the world of politics. You know, there's members that move on from time to time, and that opens up seats, and we got one coming up. There's an open seat in Tennessee's 6th Congressional District, and we have one of the candidates. I think he's the first one to jump in, is my understanding. Johnny Garrett from the great state of Tennessee is joining us on the line. Johnny, thanks so much for being here on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Jason, thank you very much for having me. We appreciate you and appreciate your network. This is fantastic to be here.
Oh, well, thank you. I you know, there comes that point when you sit down either by yourself or with your family and you think, yeah, I think I'm going to run for Congress. So what made you think, hey, you know, I want to ruin my life and and dedicate myself to this public service? I say that with a great smile because it's a great honor to serve. I'm very blessed that I was able to do so. But you want to do that. Why?
I think I'm a fighter. I think I'm a conservative fighter. And I have been impressed with President Trump the moment he got in just over 10 years ago. And I'm looking forward to standing with him and being a conservative fighter for the district here in Tennessee and making sure we pass his agenda. That's what fires me up. That's what wakes me up in the morning. And I'm ready for that fight.
Now, a lot of people will say, yeah, I'm a conservative. But then the push comes to shove and you start to think, all right, what does that really mean? Like, and so, look, Tennessee overall is fairly conservative, but when I say conservative, you want to help Donald Trump. What issues fire you up probably as much as anything?
Well, look, the biggest issue I think for Tennessee is what we've done is we keep money in our citizens' pockets. We balance our budget every year. We control spending. We make sure that the federal that our state government here is obviously not too big, limited. That's why I want to take what I've learned over the past 7 years here being a state rep and take the little Tennessee to D.C. because D.C. Needs to act more like Tennessee.
Yeah, no kidding. So your experience there in the state house, because Tennessee is a well-managed state by all accounts. I hear nothing but good things about it. And, you know, states are forced to balance their books. What's your take on the one big, beautiful bill? Is that something you would have voted for? And let's just go from there.
Well, absolutely. Anytime that, you know, the federal government doesn't make any money. The government doesn't make any money. It's all the people's money. Anytime we can give the people's money back to them, I'm on board. And so, absolutely, if I was up there, I would vote for that bill. And I think we've got more work to do, more spending cuts to make. And so I would be proud to support President Trump and vote for the big, beautiful bill.
Professionally, before you did, or, you know, as you're doing the State House, what tell us a little bit more about kind of where you're from, but why you wanted to get involved in public service.
Sure, sure. Well, I'm a seventh generation Tennessean. My roots go all the way back in my hometown. And like you said before, in your service in the Congress, which I'm proud that you served, honored that you served, it is an honor to be someone's voice. And that is what I want to do here in Congress, is be their conservative voice, knowing they can trust what I say, what I do, because I have a history. I have a record of being conservative here in the State House, and I want to take a little bit of Tennessee to D.C., and that's what motivates me. That's why I want to do this.
You know, one of the issues we keep reporting on are the idea of, you know, transgender males participating in women's sports. Is that a tough issue for you? Where are you at on that one?
Oh, well, as a dad of two daughters, that is, again, another reason why I'm in this race, is to stand with President Trump, because just like you said, going after the crazy governor in Maine, that if you don't get rid of men playing in women's sports, we're coming after you. Well, let me tell you, as a father of two daughters, I'm going to be right behind them. It's absolutely ridiculous that we even have to have these conversations where men can compete with women and our daughters in sports. It's outrageous.
No, it is. It's unbelievable. Look, you've had a for the most part, a Tennessee delegation. There's some exceptions in there. Congressman Cohen, for instance. But there are, you know, your delegation has been, like I said, very conservative, not only fiscally, but also on some of the social issues as well. If you had to kind of tap the three big issues that Tennesseans are talking to you about, what they're concerned about for the country, things they want addressed, what are those big three?
Well, look, one is pocketbook issues, right? They just lived through 4 years of the worst president that I believe we've ever had, with skyrocketing inflation, milk, egg prices rising. I mean, the number one thing is their pocketbook, right? They need to be able to spend their own money the way that they can. You know, we got to get our spending under control in D.C. Got to get our debt control under control in D.C. There's so many more. Good gosh, I could take up all the time that I have here on the issue that we need to tackle and we need to fight for Tennesseans.
Well, listen, you know, running for Congress is a tough thing. It's tough on the family, tough on the kids, takes a lot of time away. But we wish you nothing but the best in that quest to try to represent. And, you know, so few people raise their hands and do it. And I wish you all the best. I know there'll be a bunch of people, I'm sure, running, but you know, congratulations for making that tough decision. It's the race is in 2026. Johnny Garrett, candidate in Tennessee's 6th Congressional District. Thanks so much for joining us on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Jason, thank you very much. And for your listeners, go to johnnygarrettforcongress.com and you can learn more about me. We appreciate you.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Lot going on in the world. Lots more to talk about. Oh, my goodness. We got to talk about the FBI. We got to talk about, you know, what's going on with Brenner and Clapper. There's a lot happening. Stay with us.
This is Jason Chaffetz from the Jason in the House podcast. Join me every Monday to dive deeper into the latest political headlines and chat with remarkable guests.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com
or wherever you download podcasts.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, thanks for joining us on the Brian Kilmeade Show. I'm Jason Chaffetz, actually filling in for Brian where he gets after he gets some much needed a little rest and relaxation, maybe a little bit of family time in Brian's life. I think that's great. We got a lot going on in the world, and we're going to try to talk about all of it, but probably one of the things that really interests me is what's going on in the world with the federal government as it relates to our food. Because I just feel like fundamentally, top to bottom, the federal government lied to me my whole life. And so we have Dr. Nicole Sapphire. She's joining us. Dr. Sapphire, thanks for joining us on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, Jason. Happy to be on with you.
Now, you broke some rules, Nicole.
Uh-oh. Yeah, that sounds like me, though.
Yeah, you broke some rules. Let's explain to the listeners what the rule is as it relates to stairs and socks.
Oh, yeah. Well, Jason, about December 2020, in the thick of COVID, I was walking with socks on my staircase, and I didn't have runners. So top to bottom, I fell down 13 stairs. The good news is I didn't hit my head. I didn't hit my neck, but I sacrificed my arm to protect my head and neck. So I am homebound right now. I just had my third surgery to put my arm back together after that fall.
I am so sorry. But what's the rule in the Sapphire household? What's the rule?
No socks on stairs.
And? You wore
what?
Socks on stairs.
Yeah.
I know. And then you took this horrific fall. I'm so sorry. Three surgeries. But I know you'll be out there throwing those fastballs sooner rather than later. You're not exactly the best patient. I can tell by watching your Instagram. You had surgery, and next thing I know, you're outside doing things.
Well, I mean, I did have surgery last week, and I will say I am an okay patient, but doctors do make the worst patients. But, you know, FIFA 2025, I had to take my kids to go watch Real Madrid. So, you know, sling, bandages and all, off we went.
There you go. Listen, you've been on top of this. You've written books about healthcare and COVID and all of these things. But let's talk about real time here. Cause I was serious when I was doing this introduction. I feel like my federal government lied to me. That food pyramid. I mean, and I'm getting the number wrong, but I was supposed to have like 11 bowls of grains and cereals every day. I would go to bed until recently. I would have two bowls of cereal before I went to bed thinking I was doing my body good because I was eating life. How can it be worse? I was eating life. You're telling me I did the wrong thing? Now they're telling me, oh, you had carbs, you had sugar. I'm like, but I was eating cereal called life.
Well, so first of all, the food pyramid, you know, that was developed several decades ago, we have evolved in our research when it comes to what is really good for you. But the reality is we have the knowledge. You know, I wrote Make America Healthy Again, May 2020. It's essentially talking about where are people the healthiest, why are they the healthiest, and what the heck did our government do to kind of make it all wrong. And the reality is, if you look at the blue zones all across the world, that's where people live the longest and the healthiest. It's all about the Mediterranean diet. Now, part of the Mediterranean diet, you know, a lot of seafood, a lot of fruits and vegetables, also has to do with walking and socialization. But there are still grains in it. And the reality is, if you travel anywhere outside of the United States and you have grains, you have breads or pastas or whatever it is, they're entirely different than what we are consuming here in the United States. And that's because here in the United States, you know, everything is all about instant gratification. How can we make it as cheap and efficient as possible? So we have all of these ultra-processed, ultra-refined starches in our grains. So not all grains are created equal in the world. And unfortunately, here in the United States, we tend to have the unhealthiest version of them.
Yeah. I mean, I go all over Asia. I've been to Asia multiple times. I go to Japan. I can't find a fat person to save my life. Like, they got these.
And they eat a lot of rice, by the way.
They are eating rice with everything, but they're walking. They're always exercising, and they are, you know, eating a lot of seafood. I'm not just trying. I mean, it literally is like that. I actually read this book about this. I can't even remember what it was called, but it was about the community that had the most 100-plus-year-olds, and their common denominator was they lived in hilly areas that they constantly were doing stills, not just stairs. They were not just walking, but they were walking uphill, which was another key factor. It was just one of the takeaways in this mini book, in these book. But let's go back to what we're doing here in the United States, because I was a little skeptical of RFK Jr., but I love what he's doing and the way he's doing it. And now, you know, talking about food dyes, you got some, you know, some that embraced it and said, hey, yeah, we're going to work to transition out of this. But, you know, there's an article up on FoxNews.com right now. Headline is Popular Candy Maker Pushes Back on RFK Jr.'s MAHA Initiative to Ban Synthetic Food Dyes. What's the right answer on this?
Yeah, so first of all, you know, when it comes to RFK Jr. in his role as the Secretary of HHS, there are some things that I'm not loving, but there are also some things that I really do think heading in the right direction for our country, and one of it is our food supply. Now, what you're referring to right now is the HHS and the FDA essentially have come out and said, we want to phase out these petroleum-based food dyes from our food and beverage industry. Good news. We should be doing this. You know why? Because elsewhere in the world, they've already done this. They didn't just do this yesterday. They did this years ago, if not decades ago. The United States, for whatever reason, continues to lag behind, and that is because we have huge lobbying and big company interests that influence our government. And so you already have some companies that have said voluntarily they're going to start phasing them out. That's great. We should have been phasing these out a while ago. There's no reason to have some of these chemicals in our foods. We don't allow them in our cosmetics. We certainly wouldn't want to give them to our children, because based on a lot of animal and rodent studies, they show that these could potentially be cancer-causing, and we already know our cancer rates are high, so we have to start phasing out some of these unhealthy things that we're consuming. Now, a couple of candy companies have come forth and said, you know, we're not necessarily going to voluntarily phase these out. Why? Because people, when they eat candy, they're not under the guise of they're eating something healthy. People don't consume candy the same way that they do like cereal. There are some children who are eating cereal with these synthetic food dyes every single day. Now, that is so unhealthy. That is why we have an obesity problem in our kids. So, yes, I understand it's more important for the cereal companies, which have like these healthy labels on them, even though they're not healthy. They need to get that out. And so the candy companies like, do we really need to do this? People know that candy is not healthy. And by the way, they don't consume it every single day. But here's the question I have for you, Jason. The same candy, if you go get it in France or somewhere in Europe, the colors aren't as vibrant. You know why? Because they've already removed it from there, because the government has said it can't be allowed in it. So why not just have a one-size-fits-all? If one government says it's probably unhealthy, why can't we just take it out? Like, please, I don't need lime green candy. It can be a muted green. I'd be fine with that.
You mean, are you trying to tell me that my Diggum Smacks were not healthy? Because I really bought into that frog. I thought that that was bringing me the nutrition and protein that I was looking for. You are right. Because, like, I think the example, I hope I get it right, was Fruit Loops. You know, we got a very bright, you know, it's fruit and in loops. How could be wrong with that? And they were so vibrant in their colors. But I'm eating fruit because they're Fruit Loops. But they're not, yeah, I mean, they use these words and how they market it, and you're right, the color, to make it that much more enticing. But yeah, I'm probably kidding myself if I thought Captain Crunch but how about King Vitamin? I grew up in the era of King Vitamin. I was getting 12 essential vitamins.
Yeah, what about the Flintstone vitamins that are brightly colored? Like, come on.
Yes.
Full of sugar and chemicals. Maybe they're getting a little vitamin C.
Well, they didn't taste good.
You know what? Just go give your kid an orange.
Well, but Nicole, I probably ate 12 years of Flintstone vitamins with my breakfast. And the orange one, yeah, kind of tasted a little bit like orange. But did it need to be, you know, it wasn't the same as eating an orange. I agree. But I'm just telling you, this is how I grew up, how I survived, knowing what we know now. It's just unbelievable to me.
Yeah, but
because
these
were the go-to things.
The reason that this is becoming an issue is because look at our rates of dementia, cancer, autism. We have so much disease plaguing Americans, more so than the rest of the world. we have to take a look at what we've been consuming. Just because it was okay a couple of decades ago, that may be what has ultimately led to where we are now. And it's going to take a while to pull back the damage that has been done, but we have to get back to the basics. We have way too much manufactured artificial products that we are consuming, whether it is from our lotions, our creams, our the drinks, the water, the food. We are causing disease in our bodies, and it is not a one-size thing. You can't just point to one thing that's causing it. It's everything. The fact that our kids are having puberty way too early. Kids are getting a lot of hormonal issues, metabolic syndromes. They're growing super tall because they have been exposed to hormones and steroids in the meats we're consuming. There's so much, Jason, that's going on, and it is going to take decades, if not century, to kind of right the wrong that we have done by all of the consumption that we've been doing of these products. And now, by the way, I'm not someone who's saying go live off the land and you have to eat everything, you know, from a pure garden and you can't go to the store anymore. You know, I've never been that person. But at some point, we need to look at what we're doing. And, you know, when I go to the store, I look at hormone-free meats because I don't want my kids eating something that has already been injected with hormones, you know, that's going to disrupt their own hormone system. So you want to try and eat as healthy as possible. And unfortunately, the healthier the food, the more expensive it is, and people aren't able to afford it. And that's why it's crucial that the HHS under RFK Jr. get involved to make sure that everyone has access to healthier foods.
Well, I can tell you, I trust Dr. Marty McCary a heck of a lot more than anybody else has been in there. And RFK Jr., who is actually talking some sense now. But that's why I started by saying I feel like I've been lied to my whole life. I mean, that's what I thought the FDA was there to do, was to protect me so I didn't have to decipher every label of everything and try to figure out what the balance is. How we do food labeling in this country got better, but still so much of it is hidden. And they can get away with some generalities without the specificity that they should be doing in terms of labeling, and not just food, but also chemicals, household cleaners, those types of things. You should really know what these things are so we can make an informed decision.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, they're brightly colored. They are cheap, and it's what people gravitate to when they go to the grocery store. And so the one thing I say, when you're in the grocery store, you on the periphery, because that's where you're going to find the natural fruits and veggies and the things that are healthier for you. It's when you get to the center of the grocery stores in those aisles, that's when you start finding the heavily processed and unhealthy stuff.
Well, if you're talking about my Doritos or my Cheetos, you've gone a step too far. I can just tell you, there will always be room for Fritos in my life.
Everything
my dad used
in moderation,
to,
Jason. Everything in moderation.
I grew up with a dad who would take a bag of Fritos and a pint or a quart of ice cream. He would scoop the ice cream with his Fritos while he watched, you know, football on Sunday. Yes. And he was not a large man. I don't know how. The Chaffetz family was relatively slim and trim for the type of diet that we were eating. I can tell you, I don't know how we got from here to there, but whew, we are fortunate.
Well, I may raise my own chickens and have a massive vegetable garden, but there will always be Oreos in my pantry. And that is the truth. And I'm okay.
You
with
can't
that.
Eat an Oreo. You can't get an or you can't eat an Oreo and then deny that you've eaten it, because it will manifests itself between your teeth. Like, yeah, if you smile, you know that it has happened. But I don't know. Sometimes I just break it apart and eat just the white part. We've all done that. Let's be honest. Just scoop out the white part, throw away
thing,
the black
I eat
part.
Three of them.
I try to eat the cookie dough before it actually gets cooked. That's my go-to. Dr. Nicole Sapphire, always enjoy it. We wish you nothing but the best on the fixing of that arm. We need you back on the pitcher's mound here throwing fastballs. So good luck with that. But thanks so much for joining us on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Appreciate it, Jason. Have a great day.
Oh, real quickly, your books. Tell us about your books and how to find you real quick.
Well, Make America Healthy Again, Panic Attack and Love Mom are my three best-selling books. They're all available on Amazon. It's Amazon Prime Day right now, so you might want to check them out. You can also find me on Instagram and X, as I tend to be active, especially when I'm bored, like I am right now.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate that.
Not right thanks, this minute, just now not being in the hospital because of my broken wing.
It is amazing that you wrote a book called Make America Healthy Again. I wonder where they got that from.
Imagine that.
Imagine that. Before it became a thing. Dr. Nicole Sapphire, thanks so much for joining us. We'll be right back.
Thanks, Jason.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade.
I'm Janice Dean. Join me every Sunday as I focus on stories of hope and people who are truly rays of sunshine in their community and across the world.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
We will take in about $100 billion in tariff income thus far this year, and that's with the tariff, the major tariff not having started till the second quarter. So we could expect that that could be well over $300 billion by the end of the year. We don't agree with CBO scoring, but for those who do, the CBO scored tariff income over the next 10 years at $2.8 trillion, which we think is probably low.
Those are some big numbers. Again, that's Secretary Scott Bessent, who is addressing the issue of tariffs. Now, there are a lot of businesses where 100% of their imports for their business come from overseas, and this is obviously very disconcerting. I would like to remind people that for those products that are made in the United States, there are zero tariffs. And I think that's the point of where Donald Trump is going. And what he is talking about is that you have to understand where we're at, where we're going, and the message that he's trying to portray. Let's go to cut number 8 as he tries to explain this.
When we charge tariffs, see, what people don't understand, the other countries have been charged, almost every country charges us tariffs. We had deficits with everybody for years, for decades. And we were like this big monolith that made bad deals with everybody.
I think Donald Trump has really won a lot of people over on this. You know, you had the Fed chairman saying that we think that he thought that tariffs would make cause inflation. They really haven't. We haven't seen the inflation that they predicted there might be. It is time, I think, for the Federal Reserve to start reducing interest rates. That combination will really make the economy take off. The big, beautiful bill, reduction in taxes. You can reduce the interest rates, and then tariffs coming on board, the country will start moving in the right financial direction. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Stay with us. A lot more to come.
This is Jimmy Failla, inviting you to join me for Fox Across America, where we'll discuss every single one of the Democrats' dumb ideas. Just kidding. It's only a 3-hour show. Listen live at noon Eastern or get the podcast at foxacrossamerica.com.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
And if you think you're listening to Brian Kilmeade, you're really not, because it's Jason Chaffetz. I'm filling in for Brian, and there's a lot happening in the world. And that's what I love about Brian's show. You can talk a little bit about everything. And this next topic is really, these next two guests, I just love it. We're going to talk about some things that maybe you haven't heard of before, and you probably should, because they affect every single person's life. And so my next guest is Emily Dominich. She's the executive director of the Federal Permitting Improvement Steering Council. Think of it as the Permitting Council. And this is really important because you're talking about energy and infrastructure and why don't things flow as fast as they could. So, Emily, thanks so much for joining us on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Jason, thanks so much for having me. It's great to be back.
Now, first of all, let's get this out of the way. We know your brother. Explain to us who your brother is.
Yeah, Ben Domenech is my brother. It means that I have to answer for all the things he says. I hope not. But no, I've got a good famous family, so I have to hold up the family name.
No, well, that's good. He's a good fun guy and a really smart mind. And everything I've heard about you, I've never talked to you before. You're a pretty smart person too. So, explain to us why this is so important. What's going on? And why do things move so slowly? At least they seem like they move so slowly.
So I recently took over the role running the Federal Permitting Council, was appointed by President Trump to help to speed the process for large infrastructure projects working their way through the federal permitting system. In a perfect world, all of our permitting agencies would talk to each other and coordinate and things would move in a predictable, transparent way. But we know that's not how the government works. So the Permitting Council was created about 10 years ago to help to be the Sherpa for those large projects so that they don't get stuck in the quagmire of federal regulations. There's a lot of things that need to be done on the legislative side to speed up this process, but I give President Trump and the folks in the White House so much credit because they said, hey, what are the tools that we have right now that we can really use to move projects forward that meet with the president's agenda, that achieve that energy dominance agenda, and how do we use them? And the Permitting Council happens to be one of them. So one of the areas you've seen us really lean in the last several months is moving mining projects forward here in the United States. The average time it takes to get a permit to build a mine in America is 29 years, which is crazy.
29 years? That's the average? You mean some are taking longer than that?
Years. Oh yeah, it sounds insane. And it's because it is. We end up with agencies that have, you know, one hurdle where a project developer can never find out what they're missing. They're told their application is incomplete, but it takes months and months and months to find out why. And the folks at the Permitting Council, my team here, we work with individual project developers to help stop those problems from happening. So we can call the agencies, we bring people together, we facilitate that public timeline, and then we keep federal agencies on time, which is no small task.
So it strikes me that the moment somebody wants to do something, then all of a sudden, what's going to happen? Somebody's going to sue somebody. And then they throw up their hands and say, well, we'll be in court for the next few years. I mean, am I wrong in that? Or is that just like one of the biggest major impediments?
No, you're absolutely right. Judicial reform is a critical part of fixing our permitting system. That's something that largely will fall on Congress to fix. And there's a lot of great members of Congress who are working on proposals to move that forward, hopefully in the next 2 years. It's next on the docket for a lot of members after the reconciliation bill. But the biggest problem with those lawsuits is that they're often filed by people who don't live in the community where the project is being built.
Right.
So they're airdropping in environmentalists to file lawsuits. And they often lose. The vast majority, like 80%+ of lawsuits that are filed against federal permits, they end up losing in court and the permit gets approved. But it's taken so long that project developer has lost their financing or lost their ability to move forward with the project just because of the delay. So one of the things we do at the Permitting Council is we put their whole project timeline, it's all public and public facing. So we have the ability to go, those folks can go to investors and say, hey, there's a federal government agency that's dedicated to helping us meet this timeline, which can help prevent them from losing that financing that's so critical to finishing the projects.
So if you could pick two or three things, it's like, these are the two or three things we need to fix to speed this whole process up, what would those be?
So you already hit the nail on the head with the judicial review piece. We need to limit the standing and ability for people to file frivolous lawsuits against large infrastructure projects and federal permits. That's one step. We need to then limit the scope of where these permitting laws actually apply. In fact, the folks over at the Council for Environmental Quality in the White House have done a fantastic job of setting new guardrails and shrinking the number of pages in the regulations across the government for where NEPA applies, which is the law that most of these folks sue under. So that's a good first step, but Congress needs to limit it further. And then the third thing I would say would be ensuring that we keep telling people it's a good time to build in America and use tools like the Permitting Council to help people get through the process as it exists today. We can't afford to wait. We will lose to China if we don't fix this problem and use all of the tools we have to move things forward now. We can't wait 2 years or 4 years for Congress to come up with the next big deal.
Yeah, you know, I live in the Rocky Mountains, right? I live out west, and I-70, which probably most people are familiar with because it goes all the way across the country, but it dead ends at I-15 there in Utah. But there's this big stretch of 100 miles or so, the last part of I-70 on the west side of it. And as you're going along, it goes through some brilliant, beautiful rock formations. And I've commented to my brother a couple times, there's no way they would be able to build this highway today, because it would just be decades of being tied up in the courts and tied up with permitting. But it was such a vital road and still is today for interstate commerce and just people trying to get from point A to point B. But boy, you go from Green River, Utah, and try to go west, you know, whether you're headed to California, Las Vegas, St. George, Salt Lake, Reno, wherever you're going, you really need to go past there. But they would never go through that place anymore. Are we going to be able to do these big, lofty projects in the future, or is it just going to get totally bogged down?
I certainly hope so. And I think, you know, a huge part of achieving that energy dominance, energy abundance agenda is being able to build large infrastructure projects just like that road, again, here in the United States. We have to streamline the process as much as we can. But I love that you brought this up, because it's such an example of why the environmental left is wrong on this issue. We have an incredible track record of environmental responsibility in this country and conservation and the ability to build large projects and develop our resources on public lands and rural lands in the West in a responsible, environmentally friendly fashion. We do it better than anyone in the world. So if we don't build it here in America, the alternative is that these things get built in China, where they don't give a rip about the environment. And they certainly don't care about preserving the kinds of things that we value here in the United States. So I truly believe that, you know, the leadership from the White House is pointing us in the right direction to give charge to these agencies, that we need to do things quickly, that we need to build, we need to get as many shovels and dirt as we possibly can throughout President Trump's term. And then we need to think long term about how we improve the process by getting rid of the sort of bureaucratic hurdles, incorporating AI and technology into how we evaluate projects, and then giving project developers the ability to go out and build things in a responsible way. They don't want to make those communities mad. They want to keep people happy. So it really does serve the developer to invest and build in a way that preserves that natural environment.
Well, Emily Dominich, the better half of the Dominich brother-sister combo here, thank you so much for joining us on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Really do appreciate it. Best of luck, because it does affect all of us. It's one of those things, if it doesn't move, then we all suffer the consequences. So more power to you, and thanks for joining us on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Thanks for having me, and we hope we can build more things in your community.
Very good. We'll be right back.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
Hey there, it's me, Kennedy. Make sure to check out my podcast, Kennedy Saves the World. It is 5 days a week, every week. Download and listen at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Well, welcome to the show. Glad you're sticking with us, because this is going to be a really interesting discussion. One of my favorites out there is Jim Bridenstine. Do you know who Jim Bridenstine is? Well, you should, because he's the former administrator of NASA. He was also a congressman. That's how I got to know him. He was served in the United States Congress before Donald Trump in the first Trump administration. tapped him to be the NASA administrator. Jim, thanks so much for joining us on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Well, it's fantastic to be here, Jason. Always a pleasure to join you.
Well, look, you do a great job of taking something very complicated and synthesizing it down to something that even I can understand. So, you know, when I think of NASA, right, you think of space stations and space shuttles and rockets, but it's also a lot more than that. You know, and we talk about satellites. I don't know that anybody has a full comprehension of how the breadth of use of satellites and what we do in our daily lives. You know, with all the flooding that's going on, the weather predictions, I just wanted you to kind of walk us through NASA's role in weather predictions and how it's used just overall in our communications and everything else.
Absolutely. So NASA historically is the purchaser of satellites that NOAA needs for operations to predict weather. And so
explain NOAA. NOAA.
Yeah, okay.
We talk a lot about NOAA, but it's North. Yeah.
You bet. So it's the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And they are the agency that under which you have the National Weather Service. And right. NOAA is the agency that purchases the weather satellites. And they generate the requirements for NASA to go forward and acquire on behalf of NOAA, which has the National Weather Service. So it all works together. NASA, of course, is really good at acquiring space hardware, and NOAA has all of the talent to operationalize that space hardware. And, of course, I got super involved in this coming from Oklahoma, where we have constituents that die every year in tornadoes. We worked really hard to make sure that the weather prediction capability was there. And at one point, we had a real challenge, and we still do have a challenge, as a matter of fact. We're trying to increase the lead time for people who need a warning on a tornado. Right now, the lead time on average is about 13 minutes, and we can increase that. And by the way, it's 13 minutes because we lead based on detection. We have to see a tornado, and then we warn people. But we need to move to a day where we warn based on the forecast of a tornado. And the state of Oklahoma is really keen on seeing that through. The University of Oklahoma has been involved in that type of research. But if we can warn based on the forecast, we can save a lot of lives and move to a day where we don't have any deaths from tornadoes. So I think all that is important. And these are agencies, I think, that are critical for our country. I would also say, Jason, if you'll allow me for just one second, I know you've talked a lot about the reconciliation bill, and I saw you on Fox News advocating hard for it. Very important piece of legislation for so many different reasons. But our friend Ted Cruz really went to bat on the reconciliation bill to preserve a whole lot of capabilities for human space flight. As you said, Jason, human space flight goes well beyond just exploration and science. It is an amazing tool of diplomacy for the United States of America. It keeps all of our allies around the world focused on us rather than joining China. And China is using their space station for a lot of advanced materials that can be used for hypersonics and other things. And we don't want our allies sending their astronauts to our adversaries. So Ted Cruz, worked really hard to increase spending for NASA. And by the way, he did it with an offset so that it did not increase the deficit in any way.
I want to talk about the Space Force, but before we get into that, if we have time, because we're running out of time, talk to us, though, about Texas flooding and the floods that we've seen. And we got it going on in New Mexico. We've had some in North Carolina. We've had some horrific flooding. And one of the questions is, how do we get the warning out? Now, ends up that some of the Democratic rhetoric has been off, just totally off base, because it ends up that the staffing levels at the National Weather Service were higher than normal. But what can we do? What can NASA do to better improve the prediction that this massive wall of water was going to come flowing down this river.
Yeah, that's a really important point. We do have assets in space that are always looking at the Earth and monitoring changes on the surface of the Earth. Now, a lot of those assets are used for science. They're not necessarily used for what this particular issue was, which is a flash flood. But we do have the ability to use, in fact, weather satellites and weather radar and other ground systems to monitor and, in fact, predict when and where the rain is going to fall. And then based on that, we can model where the rain will end up because of the river systems and the creeks and the tributaries and everything else. So we do have assets that do that. In this particular case, I think the warnings were actually there. I just don't think they got to the public. And again, I have not studied this issue in depth, but I know the systems were there. The systems worked. As you said, the people, this was not an issue of funding. Nobody made any cuts that created this problem. Of course, the rhetoric from politically charged operatives has been horrific on this. But the truth is, for whatever reason, and I don't know the reality, but for whatever reason, the warnings didn't get to the right people at the right time. And that's an issue that members of Congress and others, I'm sure, are going to have hearings about and get to the bottom of.
Yeah, I mean, part of the issue is it happens in the middle of the night. You know, when something's going down at 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, how do you do that? And obviously, yeah, it was catastrophic. I mean, we still have some 170 people missing in Texas. You have flooding going on. Three people, at least, it looks like by news reports, have lost their lives in New Mexico. Boy, that flooding video is pretty dramatic as well. But NASA plays such an important role in making sure that we have the GPS systems, the weather forecasting. It really is amazing what the agency does. Last word here as we kind of wrap up.
Well, we're just grateful that, Jason, you're one of the folks that really delves into space issues, and you're aware of it. It is critically important. Space is not just, again, exploration and science, although that's important. It is important for national security and defense, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance. We think about, as you mentioned, the GPS constellation, which is not just for navigation, but also time.
Jim Bridenstine, former NASA administrator, thanks so much for joining us on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Stay with us. We got more to come.
It is time to take the quiz.
It's five questions in less than 5 minutes. We ask people on the streets of New York City to play along. Let's see how you do.
Take the quiz every day at thequiz.fox. Then come back here to see how you did.
Thank you for taking the quiz.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, it's the Brian Kilmeade Show. I just happen to be Jason Chaffetz, who's filling in for Brian, who's doing a little vacation. He deserves it. He needs it. We got a lot happening in the world. My goodness, we've been going on the show. We got to start talking about some things that are making news that really affect your lives. And this one, whether you realize it or not, will affect your life. I'm joined in studio with Leah Siskin. I hope I pronounced your name properly, unless I was in the ballpark. She's the Foundation for Defense of Democracy's Artificial Intelligence Research Fellow. And I really wanted her to come in because we're seeing some stories now. And look, I wrote a book. It's called They're Coming For You. And it's talking about how technology data is going to be leveraged against people. And the where we're going and the technology that's already here today is being used for nefarious purposes. And one of those is playing out in real time right now. We're seeing this story of Marco Rubio, right? Marco Rubio, Secretary of State, he's got like four hats. He's National Security Advisor. He's running the archives. He's just like doing everything. So, Marco Rubio, there's evidently somebody out there using artificial intelligence and contacting other government officials saying, hey, this is Marco, and having conversations with them. This is scary stuff, Leah.
Yeah.
What's going on here? Where are we going in this world?
Yeah, you really hit the nail on the head. Technology is here, and it definitely can be manipulated and used in very dangerous ways. What we're seeing right now is really the new frontier of influence operations. So what we learned yesterday, an internal State Department cable announced that there had been deepfake voice recordings and text messages sent by an imposter pretending to be Secretary of State Marco Rubio.
Yeah.
They were sent to multiple heads of state, a governor, and a member of Congress. At this point, we don't know much else. We don't know who those heads of state were, but you can imagine, you can easily wrap your head around the gravity of this situation, how serious it is, and how effective this technology is at manipulating diplomacy.
Yeah, look, I was with Marco Rubio yesterday. I physically, you know, I didn't poke him like in the shoulder to say, hey, Marco, is that really you? But, you know, he's got a very distinctive voice. If you're ever on the phone with him, which I have, then you know exactly that it's Marco. But if it's a deep fake, now this also affects real people. Not that Marco's a fake person, but not many people get to interact with him unless you're another Secretary of State or a head of state or, you know, like a member of Congress. But, you know, if you live in Louisiana or you live in Colorado, or I mean, this is going to start happening in mass. Absolutely. How do we deal with it?
Absolutely. And one of the things that worries me is that finding deepfakes of very high level senior officials, those are almost easier to out because
right.
we can we can verify and validate what soon enough that whether they came from that person. But what I'm more concerned about is, what about lower level officials? What about undersecretaries of state that don't have that same profile,
yeah.
that or that same level of recognition? How long?
Well, what about that teenager? I mean, President mm-hmm. Trump in the joint session of Congress highlighted mm-hmm. this teenager. This poor young lady had a deep fake, a nude photo of somebody, and mm-hmm. they put her head on it, and then they were passing around, and she was terribly embarrassed. And how do you put that genie back in the bottle? And then imagine the bullying and the other devastation for a fragile young person who wakes up one day and 100, 300 people at the high school think they've seen a new picture of you.
No, deepfakes it's a whole new level of abuse and manipulation, and I'm glad that the administration is taking it so seriously. But to your point about how do we start to understand how these are being created and how they're proliferating, deepfake videos have been around. We have seen them. They are very complex to do well. It's
right.
pretty easy to see kind of a scrappily done
Instagram
video.
Something with a cat
yeah.
down jumping around doing
yeah.
a dance.
Or but even
that
if
cat on the diving board, I gotta tell you, I think that was actually real.
that was pretty amazing. I have to admit, I watched that myself.
Yes.
But deepfake audio is so much easier. This is the true low-hanging fruit here, because video requires so many inputs. It requires a pretty sophisticated understanding of
right.
and use of technology. Deepfake audio can be done extremely well with about 30 seconds of recorded audio of a person.
Really?
You can use AI tools to model our audio recording, and from that you can start to map tone, inflection, emotion, pitch, accent, speech patterns. All you need is 30 seconds of audio.
Wow.
And there are tools that are online, they're free, they're pretty user friendly, that just about anyone could use to put together a deepfake audio recording.
Okay, so how do you defend against it? What is there a role in Congress that should be done? But Congress is notoriously slow. So you're the average person, or you think that somebody might be impersonating you. Do you have to come up with safe words or code words, if you will, to
yeah.
say that, look, you'll know it's me if I use this word, and then you let your family know? I mean, what
yeah.
do you do?
This is like any other area of cyber defense. We have to have protocols and we have to have a playbook. So first of all, I know that the administration seems very comfortable using consumer grade communication apps like Signal. I use Signal. I love Signal. I understand.
Right.
But the problem is they are encrypted. That means they protect the comms, but they're not verifying the identity of the person using them. So people need to know what they're doing when they use them, that they're not truly safe. So if you're going to be sending sensitive information, they need to use a kind of formal channels of communication. Our ability to detect these fakes, especially with audio, when we don't have as many points of information to kind of suss out whether it's real or not, a lot is going to have to be based on the context. So if you get a message like the one sent from Secretary Rubio, which, by the way, were created just spoofing an account. They just created marco.rubio@state.gov on Signal. Anyone could create a fake account like that. I think you need to focus on the context. If you are getting a sudden ask for quick action, taking a minute to say, this seems maybe out of character, or this is maybe unlike this person, I'm going to take a moment to confirm by saying, this sounds important. Why don't we switch to a high side communication?
Or why don't I call you back, right?
Yeah.
There was one time where I went to one of our national labs, and the national laboratories do some really sensitive, highly classified information. And I remember asking him, and I said, how do we deal with this? We were talking about piracy, like how do we, the movie industry and the music industry suffers from this all the time, pirated copies. So I said, well, what do we do about it? And they said, analog. Analog is the way to do it. But how do we do that in today's society?
Yeah, it's hard because you have to weigh convenience and the ability to work quickly with security. That's always going to be the rub. But another important thing to focus on is whoever this imposter was knew the acronyms, knew the lingo. They were able to really accurately represent a State Department official. And one area of major vulnerability for all government agencies is just good old-fashioned phishing attacks where people are trying to manipulate you and get you to click on a link and get exposed to malware and then use that to glean information about your agency. So just reinforcing basic trainings of how to detect phishing attacks and how to prevent them in your agency is an important step one.
P-H-I-S-H-I-N-G. Phishing. if you don't know what it is, you also worry about, grandma, right? The hypothetical but real grandma who's out there. This technology is moving so fast. It's so new. They're just figuring out how to use FaceTime. And next thing you know, they're going to get a message that sounds exactly like Junior.
It's true.
And they're going to say, hey, your son's been kidnapped, or he's in a car accident, or he's, you need to. And you're right. There is the common sense that says, hey, if you're getting something that's dramatic, but we had some really demented people who contacted and in somebody's voice saying, mom or whatever it was, I desperately need this. Or this person's been killed. In one case, I remember reading a story about, imagine the devastation and the change in your heartbeat that's going on. But it was fake.
I know.
It wasn't real.
I know real world examples of all the things you're talking about, of grandma's being preyed upon asked to quickly transfer money. This isn't a matter of ignorance or internet savvy. Anyone can fall prey to this.
Is it using apps like Authy and those types of things with a dual authenticator? Where is this going? Because it just seems like the nefarious are two steps ahead of where others want to go. And, again, in my book, they're coming for you. Mm-hmm. My worry is that the government is buying and selling this data in mass. Mm-hmm. Data brokers are able to garner so much information about you. Most people are just oblivious to it. I think they look at it. The premise of this They're Coming for You book is, people want to trade convenience. Mm-hmm. They trade some personal information for convenience, but they have no idea in mass how it's spreading and being used to push people out of the economy, debanking, social credit scores, just used in the voting schemes. There's all kinds of these things going on that I think most people are oblivious to. So But the bigger question, I think, is somebody's going to get mega rich by figuring out how to create something that's verifiable. You're right. Signal's a really good example. I'm glad you brought that up because, yeah, it's encrypted, but how do you verify
that exactly who you're talking to?
Yeah.
You're hitting on so many good points.
Especially if you can do artificial intelligence with their face.
Exactly. And all the points that you made about big data and learning, you know, consumer behavior, building up profiles of people and their interests and their likes, and AI just is an absolute force multiplier for kind of every nefarious use of that data before. Right. Now we can kind of do that on steroids. So it just becomes a lot easier. And you also mentioned all the different ways that we're seeing deepfakes and whether it's preying on people or trying just for financial gain or for access to information. We absolutely do it, see it in the political realm as well. Like leading up to the 2024 election, there were robocalls, fake audio recordings of then President Biden that were disseminated, encouraging people not to vote in the New Hampshire primary.
Yeah.
So, we can do our best to debunk these things quickly, but you have to wonder how long are they going to go? Now, that's something extremely high profile. That is going to be detected and debunked pretty fast. But with the situation with the State Department, what's so concerning to me is how long did these messages go undetected? How much damage could they have? And we know that diplomacy is entirely based on trust and communication. So the wrong word, a word used incorrectly, could potentially derail negotiations that are months in the making, or destabilize a fragile relationship, or worse, even set up some sort of diplomatic crisis.
Or if somebody responds and provides classified or highly sensitive materials, that who knows where it can go to. Look, I could talk to you all day about this. It's obviously of keen interest. Leah Siskin, right? Did I pronounce it right?
You did indeed. Yes, thank you so much.
Foundation for Defense of Democracies. You do great work. You got your mind wrapped around. You are going to be perpetually employed because if you're looking into this stuff and understanding it, you're going to be a very valuable employee. So
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Coming to you on a need to know basis because man, do you need to know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Fox News Audio presents Unsolved with James Patterson. Every crime tells a story, but some stories are left unfinished.
Somebody knows.
Real cases, real people. Listen and follow now at foxtruecrime.com.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
You send the U.S. Marines into spaces they should not be. You send the National Guard in. You kidnap people off of the streets and pretend that's normal, because that's how you quiet dissent, because you make everyone afraid that if they don't do what you want, they might be next. And once you've done those nine steps, steps 10 is easy. That's when you decide there won't be new elections, because everyone's either afraid, poor, broken, or complicit.
Whoa. Stacey Abrams on ABC's Jimmy Kimmel Live. I don't know why he thinks she's worthy of that, but those are some pretty crazy assertions along the way. But let's listen to Tom Homan, the Trump administration border czar, clip 30.
We're going to do the job. We're going to do it in Portland, too. But for the mayor of New York City and Chicago, President Trump made it clear 2 weeks ago. We're going to double down and triple down the sanctuary cities. Yes. Why? Not because they're blue. Because we know there are recent public safety threats to the streets every day. Like Florida, we agree with all the sheriffs in Florida. They're taking our detainers. They're not releasing illegal alien public safety threats. They're calling us. So we can spend less resources in Florida and send them to New York and Chicago and to Portland and L.A. We're going to double down and triple down in sanctuary cities. If we can't arrest a bad guy in the jail, then we'll go to community and we'll find him. Or we'll do more work site enforcement. We'll find him at the work site. And when we do these things and we ramp up that enforcement, we're going to find others who aren't a criminal target, but they're in the country illegally. We're going to arrest them, too.
making a salient point here, right? You got a criminal element. You got people that are here illegally and committing crimes. This is the these are the most nefarious people that are out there. How they can justify sanctuary cities and then referring to ICE on these regular drumbeat that they are the bad guys. In the inciting of violence against ICE, calling them out, saying, oh, well, take off your mask. You know why they're wearing masks, those ICE officers? Because you're doxing them. You're trying to go after them and their family. You're taunting them. That's not the way we treat people. And it's this whole concept of sanctuary cities, sanctuary states, makes absolutely, totally no sense to me. You have somebody in the country illegally committing a crime. Why are you continuing to harbor that person? Give them shelter, give them, and not allow federal law enforcement to then come in and do their jobs. There should be cooperation. That's what should be happening here. But they don't see that. And that's, instead, you get the demonization of ICE as if they're doing these raids and kidnapping. They literally call them kidnappings. You have the mayor of Los Angeles saying that she's going to help get them cleared out of the park. Well, they're going after the bad people, the people that are committing crimes. And agents are under assault. The 700% rise in attacks on ICE agents, for goodness sake. These are the men and women who are doing the work that we need them to do to get rid of the criminal element. And as long as the Democrats continue to go out there and try to demonize and make an issue that this is that we're going to fight harder for people that are here illegally and committing crimes than they are innocent Americans who pay their taxes, who don't want to be victims and but become victims at the hands of some of these criminals. Unbelievable to me. It's not an issue that's going to go away. Now that the administration has the money it needs, it's going to ramp up. And I'm glad it's going to. Stay with us. Lots more to come.
I'm Dana Perino. This week on Perino on Politics, I am joined by national reporter and columnist for the Washington Examiner, Selena Zito.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com.
Or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Well, almost Brian Kilmeade. I'm Jason Chaffetz filling in for Brian. And, hey, I've been anxious to talk about this one since we started the show, and that is the FBI announcing that they're going to be looking at Brennan and Comey. And that is an interesting case, but there's nobody better to talk about this than Greg Jarrett, Fox News legal and political analyst. He's in studio in New York. I happen to be in Washington, D.C. But, Greg, thanks and welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Well, Jason, great to be with you. You and I over the years have covered this subject. And you and I both know it inside and out. In fact, I wrote two books about it. What I find so amusing, if not curious, is that, you know, why did it take, you know, so long? What has propelled the investigation of, James Comey and John Brennan is this new CIA review that found that, you know, Trump was set up on the Russia hoax by Comey and Clapper and Brennan and to some extent Barack Obama, and that they were lying about it. And just about everything in this new CIA review that exposes the truth is right out of my 2019 book, which I hold up right here, called Witch Hunt, in chapters 2 and chapters 4. So none of it, when this review came out a few days ago, and then yesterday the disclosure of the criminal investigation of Comey and Brennan, is a surprise to me because it's right out of my book.
For the people there at home, if you haven't read or seen these books, you literally wrote the book on this, Witch Hunt, and then Russia Hoax and Witch Hunt, about these cases. And you're right. This is information that's been there for a long time. I think what separates this John Ratcliffe, CIA driven report. It's that it was done by career officials. This was not, you know, the Democrats will claim, oh, this is partisan. No, you're just trying to do retribution. Now, these are career people who deal with classified information. They understand, look at all of this. And now they've issued the report, I think, which is the impetus that the Department of Justice wanted or needed, I guess, as a predicate to actually go out and start an investigation. Now, they're just saying they're looking at it. They didn't say they were indicting him. They didn't say they were going to prosecute him. They just said, we're going to look at it, which is a relief, but it does make you scratch your head why that didn't start along, you know, I don't know, maybe January 21st.
And you know, it invites the question, okay, what what charges could be brought? Based on Fox News's exclusive story of the criminal investigation of Comey and Brennan, the story discloses that they're looking at Brennan for perjury and false statements in his testimony before Congress. In my book, I recount his testimony and point out that it was a lie. And yet he was never, you know, criminally charged for false statements and perjury before Congress. So obviously that would be a potential charge against Brennan. And people say, well, I mean, you know, that testimony took place beyond the 5-year statute of limitations. That is true with one exception. The statute under law is told or extended, to use a layman's term, and it begins when you discover the information that was deliberately concealed or covered up. So the statute of limitations wouldn't necessarily begin until recently. As for, you know, James Comey, I mean, there's so many different potential charges that come to mind. One of them is a federal law called conspiracy to deprive rights under color of law. In other words, if you fabricate evidence against somebody. And again, the same tolling of the 5-year statute of limitation occurred based on concealment. And, you know, here, the violation of rights would be fabrication of evidence. Comey knew all along from the outset that the dossier was garbage. It was junk. It was phony. And yet he concealed that information and used it as a pretext to launch his own counterintelligence investigation of Trump that then morphed into the special counsel, Bob Mueller, who in the end found, no criminal collusion conspiracy between Trump and Russia.
So you're the attorney. I'm not. I know that sounds like I'm bragging when I say I'm not an attorney, but it kind of is bragging.
Yeah, forgive me. We all sin.
There are some other elements here where I think they could also potentially be on the hook. And one is the FISA, the FISA application. So when you affix your signature onto a document attesting to the court certain truths, and those turn out to be false, the question then becomes, correct me if I'm wrong, did you believe or did you have reason to believe that it was true, or did you have evidence and did you believe it to be false? And if you knowingly put false information, affix your signature, signing that, and then present it to the court, that's pretty serious.
You should have been a lawyer, Jason. You could have been another Clarence Darrow.
I faked it. I was on the House Judiciary Committee, but I was the token non-attorney.
Yeah, well, you're 100% right. And what's so interesting, and this, again, is in my book, Witch Hunt, is that eventually, although Comey was, you know, the master prevaricator and disassembled and then quite often, you know, pled ignorance and loss of memory, I think more than 300 times he said, gee, I don't recall, you know, I don't remember when he testified. But he was eventually forced by Lindsey Graham before a Senate committee to say, yes, my actions would have been different if I had known then what I know now. Right? So what Comey did was he signed three FISA warrant applications to spy on Carter Page, which gave him a backdoor into surveilling the Trump campaign. And he arguably lied in those applications under oath. He did two things. He vouched for the credibility of Christopher Steele without telling the court, oh, by the way, we fired Christopher Steele as a source because he lied. Okay, so that's deception number one. And yeah. Then the other one is he vouched for the reliability of the dossier, even though his own FBI had debunked it as pure garbage almost from the outset. So he didn't tell the truth to the FISA judges on that front as well. So you're right about, you know, charges relative to lying.
Well, and there could be other actions that we or other testimony that we have not yet seen, because as I said on Laura Ingraham's show last night, the Ingraham angle, I said one of the things we don't understand is where they may have testified under oath to intelligence committees. So when they say they're looking at,
right,
you know, potential false statements, that doesn't limit them to just false statements in public settings. It could be that whether it's the Intel committee or other classified types of briefings, that information, again, you know, was it false? Was it knowingly false? That is a universe that could potentially expand where the Department of Justice could be looking at Brennan and at Comey.
Yeah, I think so. And I think actually they may also be looking at James Clapper as well.
So I was going to ask you that before you get into that. His name is not in there. And I found that interesting because it's usually, you know, Brennan, Clapper, and Comey. And as Laura Ingraham joked about on air last night, like some, you know, personal injury law firm that's on some billboard in your local highway, you know, been in an injury? Call us Brennan, Clapper, and Comey. But, you know, I say that with a big smile on my face. But Clapper is not really highlighted as part of the Department of Justice probe. And I wonder why.
Yeah, I suspect he still is a part of the Justice Department probe, because that trio of Comey, Clapper, and Brennan, or whatever order you want to put them in, they were all in on it together. What's interesting about Clapper is that he testified that, oh, no, the dossier wasn't a part of the ICA, the intelligence community assessment, which everybody regards as gospel. And the dossier was in the intelligence community assessment. How do I know that? And wrote about it in my book, Witch Hunt, because I had a copy of it. and it's right there. It's, you know, it's in the annex, but it's relied on in the text. And, you know, and Clapper and Brennan both said, oh, no, the dossier really wasn't included in the ICA. Well, yeah, it was. What's interesting is that Brennan stuck to that, but Clapper recanted. And the other deception by Clapper is that he denied leaking the dossier, but then when caught with the hard evidence that he actually leaked it to Jake Tapper at CNN after he was hired, Clapper was hired by CNN as a security analyst, he then said, oh, well, yeah, I did leak it. So Clapper's always been all over the place, and when he gets caught red-handed, he tends to revise and recant. So is he a part of the criminal investigation? I suspect he is. We just it hasn't been made public.
Let me ask you about intent, because, look, I was the one who conducted the hearing with James Comey after he surprisingly told the world that, you know, Hillary Clinton, no reasonable prosecutor would prosecute her. But he made a big deal about intent. And I argued with him on that case, not to get us off track, that, you know, there is, she set up this homebrewed server on the very same day that she started her Senate confirmation hearings. I said, isn't that enough intent to show that she was trying to bypass the Federal Records Act? And he thought that was a mere coincidence. Of all the days in the world, that's the day she did it. And but no. So he made a big deal about intent. Yeah. The intent here, I think, would be fairly easy to document and prove based on all the statements that these three have made about their dislike, distrust of Donald Trump.
Yes. And look,
but how important is that? I guess
intent is critical. But the intent is there because Hillary Clinton was given a tutorial about how you never use any of your work product or any communications as Secretary of State on any device except a secure State Department device, which was set up for her at her office. Right. And she signed not one, but two documents saying, I understand that I will never use this on a personal device or personal server. And yet she deliberately set up such a device and a server in her own home. Her State Department account was completely empty of any communications, and everything was on her personal server. So the intent, the deliberation, the willfulness to violate the law is abundantly clear by her own actions.
So, but in this case, with Brennan and Comey, at least, and maybe perhaps Clapper, their intent, their animosity towards Donald Trump was palpable. I mean, they're on record multiple times talking about how partisan they are. That's going to come back to haunt them? Yes.
Oh, absolutely. Look, under the law, intent typically is not expressed, but rather implied from the willfulness of conduct. Hmm. And so here, look, all those guys knew that Trump had not colluded with Russia. They knew that their principal piece of evidence, so-called evidence, the dossier, was fiction. And they knew it at the outset. But they hated Trump so much, they loathed his policies, they despised the man, that they were willing to use it as a cudgel to bludgeon him politically and try to drive him from office. That was their goal. And they came perilously close to achieving it. But, you know, the thing about conspiracies and lies is that they tend to boomerang eventually. You know, the truth, inventing a lie is easy. Spreading it is easier. Uncovering the truth is hard. And, you know, but eventually, I'm an optimist. I like to think that the truth eventually bubbles to the surface. And here it has taken the better part of 9 years for some of the truth to come out. I'd like to think that most of the truth is in this book, which came out in 2019. But I, you know, there may be more pieces of evidence that will slowly emerge now that we actually do have some fair and competent people who are looking into it, principally, you know, John Ratcliffe at the CIA, Kash Patel at the FBI. I do have faith with the people in the Department of Justice, so we'll wait and see.
Greg Jarrett, the best. We appreciate you joining us on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
It's the Will Cain Show. Watch it live at noon Eastern, Monday through Thursday on FoxNews.com or on the Fox News YouTube channel. And don't miss a show. Get the podcast 5 days a week at FoxNewsPodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I'm very grateful to Brian Kilmeade. I'm Jason Chaffetz. Brian, let me sit in his seat here for the last couple days. Brian will be back in the chair tomorrow. So he'll be back tomorrow. He's got a great team around him. Lots happening in the world. People who need your prayers, who need your thoughts, who are fighting for their lives and missing loved ones, thinking specifically of the floods and whatnot. But boy, all the problems and challenges in the world, we still live in the greatest country on the face of the planet. I was able to write a book. It's out now. I know I've been touting it. I got my sales hat on here, but they're coming for you. You know, it took a good year and a half, 2 years to put it together, but I'm really critical of our government and how it's buying and selling data, your data, how it's being used to manipulate you, push you out of the economy, give you essentially a social credit score, how it's being used to manipulate you and your healthcare and elections and everything else. I think most people are fairly oblivious to it. That's why I wrote the book. It's called They're Coming for You. But my point here is only in America can you get away with my using the First Amendment, my free speech right, and my free speech rights to be able to convey those thoughts. That's the beauty of America, that we are self-critical. I can get after. I can write a book like They're Coming for You and be able to publish it and not have any repercussions. At least I hope not. This has been the Brian Kilmeade Show. I'm Jason Chaffetz. Very grateful for filling in. Thank you so much. Brian will be back tomorrow.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.